The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Ben Burgess is a philosophy professor at Rutgers, a science fiction writer whose work has appeared in publications such as Tor.com, and, most importantly, the author of Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left, which is due out next year from Zero Books. In this episode of the Zero Books podcast, Burgess shows off his nerdy bona fides by poking holes in some right-wing arguments about universal healthcare, Venezuela, and the ideas of Ayn Rand. We also touch upon the difference between Aristotelian and Hegelian logic. It's Sunday, December 16th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you like this week's podcast, you should support us on Patreon. Starting in the new year, patron supporters will get access to the Zero Books podcast and to Symptomatic Redness every week, while those listening for free will be able to listen to a full-length episode every other week. Basically, we're adopting the Chapo model with the hope of getting some more communist dollars and with the hope of expanding our podcast and video production. When we reach 600 patrons, we'll introduce an additional Commie Ideology for Beginners series that will be, of course, free to everyone. The music you're listening to right now is PewDiePie's Bitch Lasagna, as played by Davey504. And in just a moment, you'll be listening to Ben Burgess serve it up to the right. You are a logic professor who's written a book called Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left. Your book hasn't come out yet, but it's already getting reactions because we have been producing YouTube videos. What I'm finding interesting is that it's already receiving some criticism. I wouldn't say it's a controversial idea that we should be logical, but it's more controversial amongst some people than I would have expected. There's a sentiment out there that gets expressed in YouTube comments or on Facebook that goes like this. Debate is pointless. Our enemies are acting in bad faith. There's no reason to debate them. This is an exercise in futility. Have you seen that critique, and what would you say to it?
Yes, I definitely have seen some of that, certainly on YouTube comments, Twitter and Facebook reactions. And I think it's a fairly common sentiment, and I don't want to exaggerate this point, but it's a fairly common sentiment among certain parts of the left that they think that, for one thing, people will say things like, well, debates are pointless, nobody ever changes their mind. There's also a feeling in some quarters that that sort of making explicit logical arguments, or especially, God help us, pointing out logical fallacies, is a kind of trick or an annoying rhetorical pose taken by usually right wingers, and that it's not even worth trying to reclaim, that we should just sort of roll our eyes at all that stuff and move on. And I think that obviously I strongly disagree with almost all of this. I think the germ of truth is that people don't generally change their minds in debates. Certainly, if you have people debating who do this for a living, whose entire personal and professional identities are bound up in their political positions, it would be something of a small miracle if anybody, you know, just in the middle of a debate on a stage somewhere change their mind if when Nick Gillespie from Reason Magazine is debating Bhaskar Sunkara from Jacobin about capitalism and socialism, if halfway in between, in the middle of the debate, if Nick turns to Bhaskar and says, you know what, you're right, capitalism relies on the exploitation of working people, I'm ashamed of what I've been doing with my life, that, you know, that would be that would be quite something. I would be as surprised as anybody if that happened, or vice versa for that matter. And even when you're arguing with people who don't, right? Like even if you're arguing with your uncle at Thanksgiving, just to dig into that cliche, or you're having an argument on Facebook or something like that, most people aren't going to change their mind in the moment. I think that's just psychologically unrealistic. It happens, but the vast majority of the time, nobody's going to be in the middle of a heated exchange about some topic and say, you know what, never mind. I now see that you're right, because too much of your ego is bound up in it in the moment, and that's not going to happen. So why doesn't it follow from this that debate is stupid and it's a waste of time and we just shouldn't bother? Well, one, I think there's a world of difference, especially with people who aren't at the Nick Gillespie, Bhaskar Sunkara level, between saying that people don't usually change their mind in the room and saying that nobody changes their mind. People do change their minds about all kinds of things all the time. People change political positions. A lot of the people who say, oh, nobody ever changes their mind about this stuff, are people who 3 years ago were Obama Democrats, and then they became Bernie-crats, and then they joined the DSA, and now they're like a borderline Maoist. I would have wished they would have not done that last step, but at any rate, the trajectory certainly establishes that they've changed their mind. And presumably, it's not random. It's not just a matter of passing whims, right? I mean, even if I disagree with some of their positions, I'll give them more credit than that. Some of it has to do with actually hearing people explain reasons for positions that they didn't previously hold. And the standard can't be, oh, does it change your mind in that moment when you're in the middle of arguing about it and, you know, you'd lose face if you said that? No, but that doesn't mean that the argument isn't going to plant a seed that, combined with other things later on, could play some role in changing your mind. And certainly, and even when you get to the point of debating, you know, people who do this for a living, debating on a stage, etc., the point is not, generally speaking, to convince the person on the other stage. The point is to convince fence sitters, people who are watching, who might be influenced. And again, it's not that people are necessarily going to leave the hall and having an epiphany sometimes, right? But that it'll help them think about this and it'll plant some seeds. And in combination with other reasons they hear later, it might, and in combination with all sorts of external factors, it might help them change their position. And there's something particularly defeatist and depressing about this, and it's very odd, because some of the same people who say, oh, debate's pointless, there's no reason to argue about this stuff, people don't change their minds, are also people who seem to sincerely believe that it's possible to achieve socialism in the United States. I mean, as do I. But those two positions, at the very least, are in some tension with each other, because the vast majority of Americans do not currently support the expropriation of the means of production. That's not a majority position, last check. Even close to a majority position. And the same is true even of a lot of things that DSA, for example, stands for that fall well short of that. Single-payer healthcare is fairly popular, although there is widespread and deep opposition. I mean, we, you know, can get at least get a majority coalition for something like that. But a lot of the things that even a group like DSA advocates in terms of like what is sometimes called prison abolitionism. It's not always totally clear what that means, but at the very least, if it means anything, it does involve releasing the vast majority of people, at least who are currently in prison, and radically rechanging the prison system. And that's not a majority position. So if you hope to achieve that someday, you have to overcome an enormous amount of skepticism from working class people. And anything that can help you make your case, I think, is something that should be welcomed. And I think that learning how to lay out that case, to think about possible objections that people can make, and to respond to those objections, it's not a panacea, but it could certainly help.
I think some people who are reluctant to engage in debate, specifically with their political enemies, believe that it's not so much that you can't change their mind, they don't aim to change, you know, Ben Shapiro's mind, but they don't believe they can win in a debate because these people like Ben Shapiro do not act in good faith. They aren't actually being rational or reasonable in their argumentation. They cheat, basically. When you go up against these kinds of enemies, you should recognize that they're not playing fair. There's no reason that we should either, then, is sort of the argument. So my response has always been, well, you know, if they are acting in bad faith, that will become apparent if you reasonably engage them. I'm not sure that's always the case, though. And I'll give you an example. Probably 2 years ago now, I was listening to a podcast by a Catholic reactionary, and I was fascinated with what he was doing because he would have liberal activists on, and he would debate them, and he would just destroy them. They would not only look bad in terms of their arguments, they would look wishy-washy and conciliatory and sort of weak-willed because he would just wear them down. And so the liberal would be go, well, I don't disagree with that, but – and he would hit on some, you know, some probably some fundamental contradictions in their ideas because it would always around social liberalism kind of as opposed to his social conservatism. So he would ask questions like, why is it worse for a man to ejaculate on a woman without her consent rather than spit on a man? It's the same thing in physical terms. You're a materialist. The falseness of the analogy was so surprising to people, they would accept it. They would accept premises that they shouldn't accept or accept the validity of the analogy without when they shouldn't have accepted it. But even when even if you weren't to accept it, what I found was that – because I had a conversation with him. I actually had a Skype call just like this with this guy. And I kept pushing my sort of Marxist line. And at a certain point, he said, well, you're a Marxist, which means that you are irrational because you're believing that some sort of scientific economic document from over a century ago still could be relevant today. And that's all he just remained there. And I was like, well, what about germ theory? What about relativity? I mean, these are things that are very old, but they're foundationally basically still held to. We haven't abandoned them because they're relatively true. So what about those things? And he would then, you know, pull out his I've been to an Ivy League school card and start talking about the particulars of germ theory and how different germ theory is today than it was originally. And I was like, you know, like, okay, so you're telling me that germ theory as a broad concept doesn't apply anymore. But it basically he would simply not back down, and he kept moving the goalposts. And what I realized was if I actually had him on or really did this in public was that his manner was so strident and his confidence level was so much higher than mine about certain facts that I was bound to look like I lost. So how do we approach that problem?
Okay, so I want to start by circling back to the first thing you said about how oftentimes people feel like their ideological enemies, you know, your Ben Shapiro's, what have you, aren't operating in good faith. And that somehow makes it pointless to debate them, or there's a sense that you're putting yourself at a tactical or strategic disadvantage because they're not playing according to the rules. And so if we're too nice, you know, about being willing to engage with them, that'll somehow mean that they win. And I think a lot of this, one, rests again on the idea that the purpose of debate is to convince the person that you're talking to, which for certain kinds of debates is clearly not going to be the purpose. I mean, clearly, if you're not trying to convince or at least move someone somewhere, then sure, there's probably not a lot of reason to engage with, you know, with that particular person. But the someone somewhere doesn't have to be the other person on the stage. And the idea that because they're not playing fair, that somehow means that we shouldn't debate them, does strike me as a kind of moralistic argument that misses a lot of the advantage that we could take here. That because, of course, even if you assume that some particular reactionary is operating in completely bad faith, that, I mean, let's just take the extreme version, that you think that, Sean Hannity, for example, kind of knows that he's full of shit, like that he's just about smart enough to know that the things that he's defending under Trump are different enough than the things that he was defending under the last Bush administration, that, you know, he kind of knows that he's on a team and he takes his paycheck and he does what he does. OK, fair enough. But even if he does, there are an awful lot of people who are influenced by him in good faith. And presumably, whatever purpose is going to be served involves reaching out to some of those people. Now, the last thing that you were talking about with the particular Catholic social conservative interlocutor you were talking about, that is a problem. But I would say first that as far as a lot of these people who would just be too quick to accept dubious analogies and bad premises, we're kind of coming off as conciliatory to the point of being milquetoast. I think a lot of that stuff is a symptom of people not doing this enough, that as you know, like anything else, you do get better about it with practice. But it is true. And there's a fine line here, because I want to say two things, and I think they're both true. But I also do think that there is some tension between them. One of them is that we should make a distinction between debate in the narrow sense and learning how to argue well and reason well. That debate in a certain very specific sense, like you're debating someone on a podcast, or you're debating someone at the, you know, Whig Theosophic Society at Princeton or whatever, does rely on and reward a lot of things like being fast on your feet, being loud, being confident, that are sort of peripheral to the question of whether you're actually making a good argument. And when I say that we want to reclaim logic for the left, I don't want us to just become a mirror image of your stereotypical right-wing logic bro trolls. I want us to actually do better than that, to actually cultivate the skills that make you good at reasoning in ways that are more likely to find the truth. And a lot of the things that are valorized in the culture of internet debate, in the culture of posting YouTube videos, and I realize there's some hypocrisy here given the titles of some of the ones I've done for Zero, but you got to talk to YouTube in the language of YouTube. I get it. But when you're posting clips of the format, person X destroys thing Y. But a lot of that culture valorizes things that don't necessarily line up with good reasoning. So it valorizes dismissing things very quickly rather than carefully considering them from all angles to see if there's a point that you're missing. It valorizes applying a few simple principles to absolutely everything rather than you know, carefully considering places where the principles might go wrong, cases where other things might be relevant, where competing values have to be weighed. And again, those are I want us to do the better thing. Now, does that mean that we shouldn't do debate in the narrow sense? Absolutely not. I don't think that's something we should retreat from. But what it does mean is that what I'm preaching is a necessary component of what we need, but it's not the whole picture. So what I'm talking about is how to reason well, and that's absolutely something that we need to do. But there's also there is also something to be said for learning the art of rhetoric, that we want leftists who are loud and confident and, you know, not boorish and sophistish, but, you know, but loud and confident and are actually good at rhetorically packaging their ideas. The ancient Greeks, you know, talked about logic and rhetoric. You know, those are two separate things, but those are both things worth learning. And I'm in the logic business. That's the need that I'm trying to fill. But I also absolutely think that the left needs to learn to be better at rhetoric.
Can we, you know, I put forward that bad analogy from the Distributists. That's the guy's name, the Catholic reactionary. And that's how I'd label him. I don't think he would love to embrace the reactionary label himself. But I want to go back to it just to see if we can. This is one I didn't give you ahead of time, but just to see if we can take it apart. So the argument really is this, right? That in a liberal secular society like ours, the idea of sexual liberty has taken hold, which debases human sexuality in a way that leads to inconsistencies in our practices. So that, for instance, we will still hold with the idea that sexuality is somehow sacred, but we'll do so inconsistently. And the example he gave was that while we think that it's just a matter of our own personal pleasure and, you know, some material fact of life that we need not take too seriously, we nonetheless do take it seriously when push comes to shove. We recognize the difference between spitting on someone and ejaculating on them. And the reason we do is because we understand on some fundamental level, maybe intuitively, that sexuality is a sacred thing and that it's a different kind of violation to include a sexual component in an act of violence. So that's his argument. What would you say to that?
What I would say is that a mistake that people very often make, and I don't think that he's trying to pull a fast one there or anything. I've actually interacted with this guy just a tiny bit on Twitter, and he does strike me as whatever else you want to say about him as a very sincere person.
Right, I agree. I agree.
So I want to make clear, I'm not accusing him of you know, performing a trick here or anything. I think this is a good faith mistake that people from all sorts of ideologies can very easily fall into. But I think that there's a certain leap that you can make between saying that if you accept my principle, then you have to apply it in this way to this case and also in this way to this case. Therefore, if you're not accepting those conclusions, you must be being involved in some sort of inconsistency. So this is something I see libertarians doing all the time, in a way from the opposite of the Distributist perspective, that libertarians will say, well, if you agree with my particular view about the non-aggression principle and property rights and all that, you have to come to conclusion A in case one and conclusion B in case two and conclusion C in case three. But look, you're coming to different conclusions in these different cases. Therefore, you're being inconsistent. Well, that actually doesn't follow that you're being inconsistent. You could just be consistently applying a different set of principles. So all of this is just a particularly, I think, psychologically tempting form of the false dilemma fallacy, that in this case you're saying, well, either we don't regard sexuality as being anything special in terms of human experience or what we value, or we think that it's sacred in this way that means that we should really be discouraging non-traditional sexual arrangements, and we should be trying to control certain kinds of sexual expression, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that there's a perfectly coherent alternate way to think about it, where you say, no, it is central to the human experience, that it is important to us in a way that, you know, spitting is not. I mean, you also shouldn't spit on people, by the way. But I know that that's not a point of dispute here, but it's important to us in a way that spitting is not, but because it's so important to us in that way, we regard it as a particularly grave violation of personal autonomy to regulate what people are doing sexually without their consent, that we don't think that passing a law that says that you have to drive, you know, on the right side of the road instead of the left, or if you're in the UK on the left side of the road instead of the right, we don't think that's a particularly grave violation of personal autonomy, because given the way that that we're built as a species, given the kind of complex combination of biological and cultural factors at play here, it's just not that central to our experience of the world whether we're driving on the right side or the left. We're kind of okay either way. Whereas passing a law that says, you know, against sodomy, for example, you know, telling people who they can and can't have sex with, or certainly having sex with somebody, you know, without their consent, is a violation of a kind of core kind of personal autonomy. Now, you can question this in various ways, some of which might be implicit in what you're attributing to the distributivist, that you might think that, you know, we shouldn't place this special kind of value on it. And I think that's going to be a much more complicated argument. But at the very least, it just doesn't follow from the fact that on the one hand, we let people, you know, like as people with liberal, and of course, you know, you and I as radicals will often use the word liberal almost as an insult. But I think this is a point where there's not going to be any air between liberalism and radical leftism, that liberalism in this sense is a very good thing, that the purpose of socialism is to fulfill the promises of this kind of liberalism and give it more content. It's not to reject it. So there's nothing inconsistent or bad about the fact that modern conceptions of personal autonomy allow for doing whatever kind of freaky shit you want to, as long as you have consent, but treat violations of sexual consent much more seriously than violations of other kinds of consent, because there's nothing inconsistent about saying that sexual autonomy is a particularly kind of important kind of autonomy, but we don't think that sex is sacred in the way that the distributivist thinks it is.
What has to happen next in that kind of conversation, where you point out that there's basically a different starting point, is that you move then from this particular example into, I think, a more abstract kind of conversation. And in my experience doing a podcast for a decade now, what I found is that this is what happened to me as I tried to address politics in my time, maybe because I was already inclined to in that direction. You know, I had majored in philosophy, but also because it just seemed to come up that when I was having deep debates with people on particular topics, we would be led to philosophical conversations. And that for me, this shows that philosophy matters. But what happens is when you get to those levels, even Ivy League professors will just say, ask above my pay grade and in the conversation. Like, it becomes verboten to even get into that terrain. But so that's the other downside to the logical approach is that it takes, a commitment to thinking and a willingness to be somewhat frustrated. To continue to pursue ideas, you know, where they go.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I think one of the classes that I've taught in some form or another, throughout, my academic career so far, has always been some version of, intro to ethics or what some colleges call like contemporary moral issues, things like that. And a lot of the purpose of those classes, as I see them, all jokes aside about how, my hope is that by the end of the semester, the students will love abortion and hate Jesus as much as I do. But the actual point of it isn't actually to indoctrinate them, which I think in a certain way, even if you could get away with that, it just wouldn't be a very interesting outcome for a class like that. But it's to confuse the shit out of them, to give them a sense of just how hard these things are to think through, and then give them the tools to start to do some of the thinking through. So with any luck, by the end of the semester, there's somebody that you can actually have an interesting conversation with about those issues. A good friend of mine from Miami, where I went to graduate school, who was a junior professor there for a while, he's at the University of Toronto now, who said as an undergrad, he double majored in math and philosophy. And for a while, he was considering going to grad school in math. And one of the things that really swayed him towards philosophy was that unless you have a unbelievable superstar career as a mathematician, realistically, you're going to spend most of your time, as you do, realistically as a philosophy professor, teaching relatively low-level classes. And the gap between what you're actually interested in as a mathematician and like college algebra is enormous.
Right.
Whereas there are no interesting unsolved problems in college algebra. Whereas intro to philosophy is nothing but interesting unsolved problems.
Right. Right. Yeah. So there you go. Okay. So I have a few more of these arguments from the right. There's one from PragerU that I'll play a clip from.
It's very easy for a politician to stand up before voters and say healthcare is a right, and then passionately advocate for single payer or free healthcare or Medicare for all, whatever term they might use. But before we consider the merits of the government managing your healthcare, and that's what this all boils down to, maybe we should ask a more basic question. What do we mean by healthcare? Because if you get sick, and here we're talking major illness or you're in serious pain, you don't just want health care. You want quality health care. And where is your best chance of finding that? The answer is right here in America. For skilled doctors, cutting-edge medical treatments, and care without long delays, no other country rivals the United States. Not even close. Nobody from Texas is going to Canada for medical treatment. It's almost always the other way around. Sure, our health care system has lots of issues, and we should address them. But do we really want to upend all the advantages that we do have and start from scratch? Because that's what would have to happen if we completely turn healthcare over to the government. So let's imagine we make the change. We hear a lot about how great free healthcare would be, but it's only fair we look at the downside. The first is that government-run healthcare takes medical decisions away from patients, that means you, and puts them in the hands of bureaucrats. They decide, for example, how many MRI machines are going to be available, or under what conditions you can get back surgery or a bypass, or even whether you qualify for cancer treatment. That's how it works in the United Kingdom under its single-payer system. Because it has finite resources, the National Health Service, or NHS, sharply restricts access to treatments like hip and knee replacements, cataract surgery, and even prescription drugs to deal with common conditions like arthritis and diabetes. If you suffer from any of these ailments and many others in the UK, you may just have to live with the pain. And let's hope you don't have a medical emergency. In a January 2018 article in the New York Times, Patients in emergency rooms around London are described as having to wait 12 hours before they are tended to. Corridors are jammed with beds carrying the frail and elderly. To deal with the situation, hospitals were ordered to postpone non-urgent surgeries until the end of the month. That hardly seems like an improvement over what we have in the U.S. A second big problem with single-payer systems is that they are expensive. Really expensive. A recent study by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University found that a Bernie Sanders-style Medicare for All health system would cost a tidy $32.6 trillion over 10 years. That's on top of what the federal government spends on healthcare today. And this is not a new number. Other studies have found the cost to be roughly in the same range. So, how would we pay for it? Kenneth Thorpe, a professor at Emory University and health policy official in the Clinton administration, spells it out. If you are going to go in this direction, Medicare for all, the tax increases are going to be enormous. Not just for the rich, Thorpe estimates, but for working Americans and the poor too. Charles Blahaus, the author of the Mercatus study, puts it this way. Even a doubling of all projected individual and corporate income taxes would be insufficient to finance these added federal costs. And he considers that a conservative estimate. Canada knows all about exploding healthcare costs. In Ontario, the country's biggest province, those costs took up 46% of its entire budget in 2010. By 2030, that number is projected to be 80%. In other words, in a few years, Ontario will have little money to pay for anything except healthcare. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, government-run systems depress the search for new cures. Biomedical research spending in the U.S. far outpaces that of any country with nationalized healthcare, even when you account for differences in population or size of economies. That's one reason medical breakthroughs rarely come from countries where the government controls healthcare. They come from the United States, where the government doesn't. The lion's share of biomedical research and development spending in the U.S., over $70 billion in 2012, comes from the private sector. Discovering new medical cures and technology is a profitable business, and thank goodness it is. Those profits drive innovation. Take away the profits, and you will surely take away the innovation. Single payer, free healthcare, Medicare for all, they might sound great, but like all visions of utopia, they ultimately produce a lot more harm than good. I'm Lanhee Chen, fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford for Prager University.
So, for one thing, I sort of feel like I should try to say this in my most annoying Ben Shapiro impression, that they got some basic facts wrong. And in particular, they relied on this Mercatus study about the price tag of universal healthcare, which, as Matt Brunig of the People's Policy Project pointed out, if you actually read the study instead of just doing what most media outlets did and reading the pre-prepared paragraph the Mercatus people gave them and spinning the story the way the Mercatus people wanted them to spin it, but the headline they wanted to give was, hey, look at this giant number that single-payer healthcare is going to cost. And of course, they did the usual trick that anytime you want to make something sound like it costs a really enormous amount of money, instead of saying what it's going to cost per year, tell us what it's going to cost per decade. That's just a fairly standard industry trick. But they did it. So they said, oh my God, look at this enormous number. But then if you actually read the study, it says that enormous number is less than what we're going to collectively pay for healthcare in the next 10 years under the current system. It's actually about $2 trillion less. So to clarify that, it's not that the government is going to pay $2 trillion less, but the total that what we're all paying in private health insurance premiums and what the government's paying and the whole thing, that price tag is going to add up to about $2 trillion less. And that makes sense because the infrastructure costs, the administrative costs of running a single health insurance plan for the entire country are going to be vastly less than the administrative costs of having a bunch of different competing health plans, especially because when you have a profit motive in healthcare, you need a lot of there's a lot of administrative stuff going on because you're trying to find ways to defeat your competition in the marketplace, to find creative ways to deny claims for the bottom line, et cetera. And in fact, sometimes even some of the same people who will run this argument about the enormous costs will turn around and say, oh, look at all these people you're going to be putting out of work who are healthcare administrators, which is actually not that many people. And all of the bills that have been proposed for single payer by Bernie Sanders and other people always include some sort of provision for retraining or something like that for these people. But as a matter of fact, that's wrong. In the video, he talks a lot about the contrast to countries that already have single payer, which is, by the way, something that's really worth focusing on. That oftentimes people talk about single payer as if this were something we had to speculate about. That, oh, how would that really work? Whatever. It drives me crazy. Like I mean, I grew up in Michigan, an hour away from the Canadian border, so maybe that's like more real to me than it is to some other people. But it just seems like it's almost like ignore the man behind the curtain, you know, like just ignore the existence of Canada. Let's just treat this as something that is this wild utopian speculation that we have to reason a priori about what would happen in single payer healthcare. And we don't. So we have, for example, the World Health Organization rankings, which look at life expectancy, quality of services, you know, as reported by consumers, et cetera. And on that list, the United States is nowhere close. Number 24 on that list. So there are lots of countries that don't have anything like the resources of the United States. That are beating us on that list. And I think what's really telling is that when single payer has been instituted in these countries, it's wildly popular. It's so popular that even the conservative parties in those countries have to pretend that they don't want to dismantle it. So I think that's very revealing. So all of that stuff has just been kind of I think the necessary factual correctives to the premises of the Mercatus argument that, again, quoting, you know, Matt Brunig there, Matt Brunig is a kind of technocratic market socialist who's certainly nothing like a Marxist, but he's very good at responding to right-wing claims in this way. And for that reason, I'm a patron, you know, if there's been the Patreon for his policy project, because I think it's the kind of thing that we need a lot more of. But there's also a point to be made here about class struggle, which is that one of the most compelling parts of the PragerU video is when they talk about shortages in the UK. And there's a kind of more mainstream way that you can respond to that, which is correct as far as it goes, which is to say that there's actually a line in the PragerU video where he says, well, because they have limited resources, you know, they have to ration this and that and the other thing in healthcare. And which makes you think, wait a second. So in the United States, because of the bounty of the free market, do we have unlimited healthcare resources? Is there any system anywhere that has unlimited resources? And of course, the real ugly answer is that there are limited resources everywhere, and that in systems where we allow the profit motive in the health sector, the rationing is done by money. You can essentially buy your way to the head of the line. Yeah, which I certainly don't think is a particularly ethically admirable way to go about it. You know, that you say that you sort of take the kinds of things that you might, if you're teaching a biomedical ethics class, I've taught that a couple times at Rutgers and back in Miami. If teaching a biomedical ethics class, you take the kinds of things that you might give the students to argue about over the course of an hour of class. Okay, here's one person in this situation, and there's another person in this situation, and the hospital can only save one of them, and, you know, how should we prioritize that? And, you know, they might spend an hour having a very earnest argument about that. The actual way we solve that problem in American healthcare is we let the person who's in a position to do so by their way to the head of the line. So I think those answers that have been given are correct as far as they go. But I think there is a deeper point which about those shortages, which does tie into a Marxist point about the state, that no matter what kind of great reforms that you've passed, as long as you've left the ruling class in power, they're going to be able to roll them back, or even if it's not politically possible for them to do so at any given time, they're going to be able to chip away at them. And in the UK in particular, there's a very bad cycle where when you had Tory governments in power, or even new neoliberal New Labour governments, like under Tony Blair, they would underfund the health services. The underfunding of the health services means that you run into these limited resources sooner, which means that you generate headlines about beds being left in hallways.
We have a book that just came out. It's a revised second edition called How to Dismantle the NHS in 10 Easy Steps. And it goes over the history of how the Tories have worked to dismantle the NHS and defund it politically over the last couple decades, and makes the argument that the so-called crisis in the NHS is completely manufactured.
Yeah, exactly. That, you know, there's this horrible cycle whereby whereby the actions of right-wing governments create the problem in the first place, which is then grist for the propaganda mills of, oh, see what this is what happens when you have socialized medicine.
So let's move on to the next one. We have two here that we could hit. I don't think we're going to get through all the ones I sent you, but we could talk about Ayn Rand, or we could talk about Dr. Thomas Sowell. Which one did you find more interesting?
I think we could do Dr. Thomas Sowell on Venezuela in 15 seconds and, like, actually have a substantive discussion about Rand.
Okay.
I'm hoping to use this conversation to apply the lessons of wealth, poverty, and politics to the current American scene and have you tell me what to think about certain statements and certain – well, you'll get the idea. Here's a quotation from Bernie Sanders, the Vermont senator who nearly won the Democratic presidential nomination. Quote, quoting Bernie Sanders, while there are some great corporations, this is the question of causation versus blame, while there are some great corporations trying to do the right thing, in my view, and I say this very seriously, the greed of the billionaire class, the greed, this is not supposed to be funny, I say this very seriously, the greed of the billionaire class, the greed of Wall Street is destroying the lives of millions of Americans, close quote. What do we make of that?
It's astonishing, but I think even more astonishing is how many people voted for Bernie Sanders at a time where in socialist Venezuela, people are starving. They're breaking into stores in their desperation to get some food. They're crossing the borders into other countries to stave off starvation. In a country that has one of the world's largest supplies of oil, that they've managed to do that in that country. And people are so utterly insulated from facts that the fact that Bernie Sanders paints a very beautiful picture is all that matters.
I think that there is absolutely no coherent way of defining socialism that makes this a reasonable argument. Now, crazy people like you and me would say that socialism involves the overthrow of capitalist relations of production in favor of an entirely new system. That includes elements like workplace democracy and collective planning. And clearly, they don't have that in Venezuela. But let's say that we're wrong. That maybe. We're even doing what right-wingers might accuse us there. We're playing some sort of no true Scotsman game about what counts as really real socialism. Fine. Okay. let's just go for the most minimal definition of socialism that you can have. Socialism is just government ownership. Okay. France has a higher percentage of government ownership in their economy than Venezuela does. All of the Nordics have higher rates of government ownership of the economy than Venezuela does. Reasonable people can disagree about the causes of and possible solutions to Venezuela's crisis, but given the evidence, it's not a reasonable explanation that this is just the inevitable result anywhere of too much state ownership.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So then let's move on to Ayn Rand on liberty as opposed to socialism.
Now, one of the principal achievements of this country in the past 20 years particularly, I think most people agree, is the gradual growth of social protective legislation based on the principle that we are our brother's keepers. How do you feel about the political trends of the United States, the Western world?
The way everybody feels, except more consciously. I feel that it is terrible, that you see destruction all around you, and that you are moving toward disaster until and unless all those welfare state conceptions have been reversed and rejected. It is precisely these trends which are bringing the world to disaster, because we are now moving towards complete collectivism or socialism, a system under which everybody is enslaved to everybody. And we are moving that way only because of our altruist morality.
Ah, yes, but you say everybody is enslaved to everybody. Yet this came about democratically. I, and the free people in a free country, voted for this kind of government, wanted this kind of legislation. Do you object to the democratic process?
I object to the idea that people have the right to vote on everything. The traditional American system was a system based on the idea that majority will prevail only in public or political affairs, and that it was limited by inalienable individual rights. Therefore, I do not believe that a majority can vote a man's life or property or freedom away from him. Therefore, I do not believe that if a majority votes on any issue, that this makes the issue right. It doesn't.
All right. Then how do we arrive at action? How should we arrive at action?
By voluntary consent, voluntary cooperation of free men, unforced.
And how do our leaders arrive? How do we arrive at our leadership? Who elects? Who appoints?
The whole people elects. There is nothing wrong with the democratic process in politics. We arrive at it the way we arrived by the American Constitution as it used to be. By the constitutional process as we had it, people elect officials, but the powers of those officials, the powers of government, are strictly limited. They will have no right to initiate force or compulsion against any citizen, except a criminal. Those who have initiated force will be punished by force, and that is the only proper function of government. What we would not permit is the government to initiate force against people who have hurt no one, who have not forced anyone. We would not give the government or the majority or any minority the right to take the life or the property of others. That was the original American system.
When you say take the property of others, I imagine that you're talking now about taxes.
Yes, I am.
And you believe that there should be no right by the government to tax. You believe that there should be no such thing as welfare legislation, unemployment compensation, regulation during times of stress, certain kinds of rent controls and things like that.
That's right. I'm opposed to all forms of control. I am for an absolute laissez-faire, free, unregulated economy. Let me put it briefly. I'm for the separation of state and economics, just as we had separation of state and church, which led to peaceful coexistence among different religions after a period of religious wars, so the same applies to economics. If you separate the government from economics, if you do not regulate production and trade, you will have peaceful cooperation and harmony and justice among men.
You are certainly enough of a political scientist to know that certain movements spring up in reaction to other movements. the labor movement, for instance, certain social welfare legislation. This did not spring full-blown from somebody's head, out of a vacuum. This was a reaction to certain abuses that were going on. Isn't that true, Ian?
Not always. It actually sprang up from the same source as the abuses. If by abuses you mean the legislation, which originally had been established to help industrialists, which was already a breach of complete free enterprise. If then, in reaction, labor leaders get together to initiate legislation to help labor, that is only acting on the same principle, namely all parties agreeing that it is proper for the state to legislate in favor of one economic group or another.
But
what I'm saying is that nobody should have the right, neither employers nor employees, to use state compulsion and force.
But when you advocate completely unregulated economic life in which every man works for his own profit, you are asking, in a sense, for a devil-take-the-hindmost, dog-eat-dog society, and one of the main reasons for the growth of government controls was to fight the robber barons, to fight laissez-faire, in which the very people whom you admire the most, Ayn, the hard-headed industrialists, the successful men, perverted the use of their power. Is that not true?
No, it isn't.
Oh.
This country was made not by robber barons, but by independent men, by industrialists who succeeded on sheer ability.
And having,
by ability, I mean without political force, help, or compulsion. But at the same time, there were men, industrialists, who did use government power as a club to help them against competitors. They were the original collectivists. Today, the liberals believe that that same compulsion should be used against the industrialists for the sake of workers. But the basic principle there is, should there be any compulsion? And the regulations are creating robber barons. They are creating capitalists with government help, which is the worst of all economic phenomena.
And Ayn Rand in general is a major figure in relationship to your book and to relationship to logic and the left, because she and her acolytes sort of stand on a certain conception of logic, almost automatically leading to Randian, you know, libertarian kind of conclusions. So I'm interested to know what you thought of that video.
Right, absolutely. So I would say, first of all, that Rand is doing exactly what I was talking about earlier, about assuming that the only possible starting point is her starting point. When the interviewer asks about abuses of power, she reinterprets and translates that into government intervention on one's behalf, that's the only possible thing that abuses of power can mean, which, of course, erases entirely, just definitionally wipes out all private regimes of power. And even though, of course, in the real world, under capitalism, bosses and landlords are often in a position to exercise much more power over us than the government is in many spheres of our lives. And in fact, really, it's like that book that I know you've talked about on the podcast, The Private Government, which goes into excruciating detail about the ways that people in modern American workplaces have a degree of control that's legally exercised over them, you know, unless you want to quit and find somebody else who would exercise just as much control over you, if you can find another job, as any totalitarian government could possibly exercise over its citizens, oftentimes much more. I think even in North Korea, by and large, when people are on their own, at least after they go home from work, the government doesn't particularly care whether you're smiling or whether you go to the bathroom. When you go to the bathroom. So in that sense, it's actually a much greater degree of control. So that's one very basic problem with what Rand is laying out there. There's also a question of a rhetorical jump between violating property rights, using force, and using violence. That this is key to a lot of libertarian rhetoric that's packaged as a sort of pseudo semi-pacifism, that that as if the difference between a libertarian and a socialist or a centrist for that matter was a difference in how willing you are to achieve your goals with force and violence. But of course, that's not really it, because as a matter of fact, any distribution of property and wealth is ultimately going to be backed up by at least an implicit threat of violence. Even if you have an anarcho-capitalist utopia where you don't have taxpayer-funded police military anymore, all you have are private militias, and everybody who has one is, you know, everybody who can afford one is really playing according to the non-aggression principle and all that, it's still the case that that no trespassing sign on your property is ultimately being backed up by an implicit threat of violence, no less than tax day is April 15th is backed up by something like an implicit threat of violence. In fact, the threat of violence is far more indirect and nebulous in the tax case than in the no trespassing case. So the real question isn't, oh, how much of a pacifist are you? How much are you willing to use force? The real question is, what do you regard as a legitimate distribution of property? And that's a substantive question about what your moral theory is. Now, the moral theory that is often assumed by libertarians, and Rand says things like this, although in a way we'll see in just a second she is not actually terribly consistent about it, goes something like this. Imagine that we're all let's say Adam and Eve are the first two people, and they're spreading out from the Garden of Eden, and their descendants they can engage in just acts of original acquisition. You see some piece of land and nobody is farming it, so you start farming it, and that's a just act of original acquisition. This language comes from the libertarian philosopher Robert Nozick. And then you grow crops, you exchange crops, maybe at some point you start using money, and then a bunch of incredibly complicated marketplace transactions play out from there. And as long as however the chips fall at the end, no matter how unequal it is, no matter how many people are starving, then it's all legitimate property, as long as nobody at any stage has used force or fraud, right? This is a standard libertarian picture that as long as the connection from the present moment way back to some just act of original acquisition entirely involves what Nozick cleverly calls capitalistic acts between consenting adults, as long as it involves voluntary market transactions, then therefore, the result is just. Okay, so three really quick points about this picture. One, it involves, I think, an impoverished notion of consent, that this is a big thing that's implicit in the traditional Marxist critique of capitalism. That if your choices realistically are to submit to the domination of an employer, or to just not be able to afford rent and groceries, then it's dubious whether we should really call that a particularly rich notion of consent. Any reasonable idea of voluntariness and coerciveness goes on a scale. It's not a binary thing, but those things make those things less meaningfully voluntary. So that's one point. Second point, even ignoring the first point, it's not really clear to me how much this picture has going for it. At a certain point, like any moral theory, you're going to be having to rely on some moral intuitions. And it seems to me that a lot of the internal consistency here is purchased by just sort of going with a couple of initial moral intuitions, oh, theft seems bad, etc., and ignoring a bunch of conflicting moral intuitions, for example, about equality. That's the second point. The third point is, even if I'm wrong about both of those first two points, in order to think that this is going to justify even any significant percentage of real-world property claims, you have to completely ignore the economic history of the real world. That even in Europe, capitalism comes into the world, as Marx says in I think it's chapter 31 of the first volume of Capital, The Genesis of the Industrial Capitalist. He's got this great line about how capital comes into the world dripping from head to foot, from every pore, with blood and dirt. A lot of capital is very dry and hard to read, but this is one of the more memorable passages in there. And he's right. I mean, if you look at the history of the enclosures of, you know, feudal lords, you know, becoming early capitalist industrialists, there's all kinds of stuff going on here that bears absolutely no resemblance to capitalistic acts between consensual adults. And that's in Europe. In the New World, the economy is built up literally by the labor of slaves working on land stolen from genocide victims. And when Rand talks in the clip about how, oh no, the industrialists who built up this country didn't get any help from the government, I don't know what she's talking about. That the actual history of the United States is so different from that, that it beggars imagination that anybody could go on national television and say that with a straight face. I mean, to pick an example that's particularly significant to Rand, because it's so central to Atlas Shrugged, the railroads, the railroad system was built by massive government land expropriation, in a deeply corrupt process where politically connected robber barons were able to, you know, to get the land that they wanted, you know, in a public, you know, what could euphemistically be called a public-private partnership. It was a very ugly process, but even if it had happened in a fairer and more reasonable way, it's almost impossible to imagine how a railroad system could come to exist in a libertarian utopia. At the very least, you'd have to have some very strange routes. Because every time you hit a farm where the farmer isn't willing to sell, you know, you're going to have to go in some sort of, you know, really strange loop.
That's the thing about the Randian view of the world, is that it really does rely on a fantasy about the origins of capital, and basically has to start by saying everything that exists now is just. So and now we're going to, you know, start playing by this pacifistic rules, which – you know, even if you did that.
Don't do any stealing starting now.
Right. Now that we've got everything, stealing is off the table. We have this bit about – I put this in about Hegel. I had one argument about Hegel that came from Hegel about gradualism, but which really doesn't fit here. Maybe we can do that some other time.
Okay, fair enough.
But we have this other part of the Hegelian dialectical logic – which I think Ayn Rand was an enemy of. She despised this sort of way of thinking, this dialectical approach to logic. And I am interested to know what you think of Hegelian logic. I've read the Phenomenology, but have not read the Science of Logic. But I try to hold with at least a rudimentary kind of dialectical approach to reasoning. I'm not sure if it's a dialectical logic or not. I guess so. But let me just start by saying my understanding of the contradictions within Hegel's thought is that it doesn't really apply on the level of logic that we normally refer to. But it has a perhaps a social component or a psychological component. So an example would be Hegelian notion of identity, where identity contains its own negation, would be from the Bible, from Paul, who would say any moral law creates its own violation. that when you conceive of a law against, say, a prohibition against murder, you've created the crime. Before you created the law of prohibition, there was no conception of murder, say. So that's not really a claim about the world outside of human relations or human cognition, but it has to do with how we create categories of understanding. So what do you make of that kind of conception of identity where A doesn't always equal A?
Okay, good. So obviously Ayn Rand, who we've been talking about, is in many ways the godmother of the right-wing appropriation of logic talk. There's three sections of Atlas Shrugged are entitled Non-Contradiction, Either Or, and A is A. They're all named after basic laws of logic. And there's a very strong, at least insinuation, that there's a pretty close, pretty intimate connection between accepting those laws of logic and accepting her particular moral and political conclusions about capitalism and property rights and all of those things. And on the face of that, if all we were getting this picture from that there's a tight connection there would be Ayn Rand, then it would be very tempting to just kind of mock that. And I'm not entirely against that. I think that leftists should have tools in our arsenal besides mockery and moral condemnation, but that does not mean that there's no place for those things. But I think what's really interesting is that some socialists seem to mirror that idea. So Rand says, oh, if you understand that A is A, you have to accept my political program. Simplifying a little bit, but she certainly seems to suggest a pretty close connection there. But then on the other side of the equation, there are Marxists who seem to think that overcoming what's simplistic or inadequate about traditional logic is intimately tied to having a socialist political program, and that there is in fact a natural connection between that binary consistent logic that people like me like and people like Ayn Rand like, and having something more like Ayn Rand's political program. I think that a lot of this comes from Leon Trotsky, because I find that a sort of interesting, I don't know if you want to say dirty secret exactly, but an interesting fact that's often not talked about a lot of the socialist movement in the U.S. Is just how much of it on both an individual and collective level emerges out of the Trotskyist tradition. That even when it comes to you and your associates at Zero, or a lot of people I know who are like in the DSA, these sort of currents of socialist thought that don't on the face of them have anything to do with it, oftentimes you dig a little bit and you'll find that we all went through some sort of Trotskyist phase in one form or another. And I think that probably does leave some kind of mark here, because if you know you're Trotsky, you'll know there's this 1939 faction fight in the American branch of Trotsky's International, the Socialist Workers' Party, and that a lot of – even though, of course, like all faction fights, it was on one level all about politics, in a lot of weird ways it ended up being a lot about philosophical logic too. And the reason is that one of the parties in that faction fight, James Burnham, admitted in the exchanges when Trotsky started talking about dialectics that, oh, I don't really believe in that. And he started talking about symbolic logic and things like this as something that's better than this old-fashioned Hegelian dialectical logic. And Trotsky and his American associates ferociously criticized them for that. And I think that taking a step back from that and going back to Rand, I think neither the Rand side or the James Burnham side, for that matter, or the Trotsky side of this argument really knows what they're talking about. That, as you suggest correctly in your question, when people talk about the dialectical method or sometimes use the phrase dialectical logic, some of the words they use are the same as the words that are used when talking about logic in the sense that's at issue when you talk about logical consistency. Words like logic or contradiction are used in both contexts, but I don't think you really need to dig into it that much to see that those words are being used in very different ways. So Marxists will talk even about like the contradiction between the working class and the capitalist class. That's a very different sense of contradiction than when you say, oh, what you just said can't be right. There's a contradiction there. That in one case, you're saying that there are statements such that given the total collection of statements, that they can't all be true because if some of them are true, others are untrue. That's one kind of claim. But I think that's a very, very different claim than saying that we should have this method for analyzing, well, if you're Hegel, the movement of the world spirit through history, or if you're a good dialectical materialist, the structure of social forces and the evolution of class interests and societies that involves looking at the internal tensions within them, and seeing how different forces and different potentials are in conflict with each other and how those conflicts can be resolved at a higher level and re-arise at a higher level. And I think that's all good stuff. I'm pro dialectical analysis. This is absolutely something that we should be doing, that we should be looking at all of the complexities and the nuances of these social forces, and to see where the potential is for intervention in them politically. And I absolutely think that it's useful to read your Hegel and read your Marx and, you know, get a better sense of how to apply that method. But happily, I don't think that there's a tension between caring about that kind of analysis and caring about logical consistency. And maybe as just one last point about this, I think that one reason people are sometimes tempted to think that there is some kind of tension there is that people will sometimes get this idea that the full complexity of real life is being somehow simplified, or the sharp edges are being smoothed over when we try to fit these things into categories of being just true or false and not both, that involves a process of simplification. And I would actually argue that the opposite is true. I think that caring about logical consistency forces us to be clear about what we mean. That, you know, because oftentimes when we're just speaking casually, you know, you say, oh, how did the job interview go? Was it good? And you say, yeah, you know, it was and it wasn't. Right. And that's a perfectly normal conversational way of gesturing at complexity. But if you actually care about, you know, in that context, it might not be worth your while. But in a context where you say, oh, what do you mean? Right? And you want to explain in a consistent way what you mean, the requirement of consistency means that you're actually forced to disambiguate. Oh, here's the exact sense in which X is true. Here's the exact sense in which it's not true. And in so doing, actually showing that there's no logical contradiction between those two things, that process actually forces you to lay out the full dialectical nuances and complexities of real life.
When Hegel will talk about something, a given thing in the world, containing its opposite, he's making epistemological and maybe even ontological claims, but he's not making a claim about he's not making a linguistic turn, maybe. I'm not sure if that's the right way to put it. But he's not saying, oh, 1 + 1 = 500 or something like that. He's saying, when we understand the world, we understand ourselves in relationship to it. So a cup that we can see is the cup, but it is also not the cup because it is a representation of the cup held by our mind. Then therefore the thing is a thing for us and it's a thing for itself. And then it goes on from there. So this is the dialectic. This is the relational foundation of lived reality. So it's not so much the kind of claims that Aristotle is making when he lays out his logic.
So I think that one of the reasons that the confusion arises in the first place is that Aristotle is interested in a lot of different subjects, and he's talking about basic logical principles, but he also does say a lot of things that are genuinely of interest to later Hegelian and Marxist interpreters. A lot of this sort of dialectical methodology is found there too. But I think that actually the richness of what Hegel is getting at there is probably going to be lost if we do think that he's just asserting logical contradictions. That when he says that the opposite is contained within the thing, he's not saying that, okay, we have some statement about the cup, and that statement is fully true, and it also just fully fails to be true, and we somehow paradoxically have these two static facts that both hold. What he's saying is that there's this, that within the complexity of the way, I don't want to go too deep into the cup thing, that I might be missing some of what's going on in the example, but I think more generally, when he talks about the opposites existing within things, he's talking about potentialities, about ways that that things change over time, and sort of fissure points that you get within the sort of complex truth about something. And so he's not asserting that X exists and also in exactly the same sense it doesn't exist. He's saying, oh, X exists, but this interesting countervailing thing Y also exists within X.
Rather than a cup, one thing that Hegel does in the phenomenology is talk about the conception of now. So now is one of these interesting words that refers to a moment in time that actually in its particularity can be taken to be very extreme, extremely particular and therefore vanishing. We're talking about now. Oh, that's gone already. Or it can be universalized. Now is always present. Now has no particular qualities to it, because while you might talk about now, in the late afternoon, you could also say now at midnight when it's dark, or now first thing in the morning. And there's still a concept of now that, maintains through all these different particularities. So the concept of now is both extremely particular and universal. That would be what Hegel would say, where you're talking about an opposition or a contradiction within a concept, something like now. And that's one of those things that Hegel says, which is endlessly fascinating, especially if you've smoked some marijuana, because it seems extremely deep, because it speaks to our experience of time and the way what is present tends to slip away from us.
So I would say that I think there's a lot to be said about the particular issue about the concept of time and how to think about whether that indexical term now really tracks some objective property of reality, or whether given the sort of frozen river of Einsteinian space time that it just tells us something about our experience, and maybe sometime in the future, we can record this. I can go to Portland, and we can get really high, and we can do a whole thing that's just about that. But I think what's most interesting about Hegel here is less the specific examples, though obviously he's going over a lot of really interesting territory, but the method that he's using to think about them, and I think that method sort of really emerges into its own in the most interesting way when a couple of mid-19th century German materialist philosophy nerds start applying it to economics.